Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to Lorewatch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore in the games of Blizzard Entertainment. I'm your host, Joe Perez, one of several lore-focused folks from Blizzard Watch, and I've got my stupendous co-host with me today, Matt Rossi. How are you doing today, Matt?
I have no idea.
I believe that is a fair response in the current state of the world. Before we get started, we are going to be answering some questions this week instead of going through with our recent series, just because people have been asking us a bunch of questions, and I'd like to take some time and actually catch up. As with everything else, there's been a recent influx of just vitriol and toxic behavior being leveraged at developers, but not only developers, but the people who make the story. And we talked about this a little bit with Anne last week on episode 200, but I feel like it bears repeating. And I don't think anybody that listens to us is doing this, but I feel like it's worth saying. It's not any one person who is making the decisions in the game, and it is absolutely your right not to like those decisions, but please don't take them out on the people that are working on this. It is not constructive. It is not good. It is not healthy. And that just makes people not want to do things like work on the games we love. You can have an opinion that says, I don't like this. Just don't be a jerk about it.
And if, say, just as a random example, it's not based on anything in real life. If somebody who works on a video game is posting a tweet about a completely different video game that they're playing and has nothing to do with them and that they don't work on, don't post 12 reply tweets excoriating them and calling them like the worst thing in the universe and otherwise blaming them for every bad thing that's ever happened in World of Warcraft. Just as a thing. Just maybe don't do that, because that's not good behavior. That's harassment.
It is definitely in the realm of harassment.
And it's also, quite frankly, it's disturbing. Like, if I tweeted, you know, hey, I was on IGN and I couldn't find this thing. Does anyone else know where to find this thing on IGN? And you tweeted a 30 thing about how I've ruined Blizzard Watch. I would be considering trying to get a restraining order on you, because that's a lot more fixation on me than I deserve. I'm quite frankly not that important. No developer has ever been solely responsible for anything that has ever happened in any video game, with the possible exception of stuff made for the Atari 2600 and maybe Pong
or Stardew Valley, Cave Story, or things that only had one person. But even that, it's still not right.
Yeah,
you can leverage your discontentment constructively and positively. You don't have to be, well, I'll say it because we get one per show, you don't be a dick about it. Just don't. It's not worth it.
And you know, if you absolutely cannot express yourself in a way that's like helpful in any way, you don't have to respond at all. Like, you don't have to tell them anything. You can go outside and find like a ball and like throw it up against a wall a lot, or get a punching bag or a baseball bat and hit the ball. Or there's lots of things you can do with that anger that you have. That is something humans have that is more constructive and, more importantly, not as terrifying as some of the stuff I'm seeing. Like, come on. These are video games. They're games. We play them.
And now, the reason,
not worth one person being made to feel afraid or upset or any of it. It just, it is not. No. especially not with what's been going on lately.
And the reason I'm bringing this up again is because when we're going to be answering some questions this episode that are definitely asking about some very polarizing decisions that have been made for the story in World of Warcraft. And I just wanted to remind everybody that, again, even if you don't agree with it, you can still be civil. That said, if you do have questions for us here on Lore Watch, or if you have it for Blizzard Watch Podcast, or now our new Tavern Watch Podcast, you can be sure to send those in to podcast@blizzardwatch.com, or reach out to us on our Discord server. We have one set aside for our Patreon subscribers as a way of saying thank you. We do look there first. And if you can't support us on Patreon and you don't like email, but you still want to do the Discord thing, we do have one set aside for Q and Podcast. Ask questions, and we have had several folks already start to send us stuff for Tavern Watch, so thank you very much. We are looking at those, and we'll be addressing or answering those questions in upcoming episodes. So without further ado, I'm going to get into our first question here. It is a bit of a long one, and it is from a longtime listener, first-time questioner. So is it canon that Queen Azjara was using some form of magical mind control to command the love of the ancient Kaldore Empire? I've heard it mentioned that she was so powerful that she could accomplish this, but I don't really think it's necessary for the story. I think it would work perfectly well for the Hoi Polloi of the Kaldore Empire to love and trust their queen just by virtue of the fact that she is their leader of their Azeroth-spanning empire. Citizens of a powerful country often feel affirmed through the actions of their state, even if they are alienated from control over those actions. In the eyes of the common people, the queen becomes the face of the empire, thus they associate its character and good fortune with her persona and personal power, respectively. Even if the aristocratic highborn were disliked, they may view the queen as separate and apart from them. In pre-revolutionary Russia, there was a strong sentiment that the Tsar was on the side of the people against the hated nobles. This gave rise to the popular saying, when lamenting the misdeeds of the Tsarist nobility, if only the Tsar knew. The sentiment was only partially dispelled after, the events of the 1905 Russian Revolution, which served as a dress rehearsal for the Bolshevik Revolution 12 years later. I think this could explain why Prince Ferondas subjects hated him so greatly, even though it was Azjara who was directly responsible for their deaths. They blamed him for taking actions that led to the unleashing of her wrath, which they see as innately justified by virtue of her providence as queen. Is it feasible, or is there something in the lore that explicitly says Azjara made everybody love her using magic? Thank you for any response. Love the podcast. And this is from Salhadin, a Warcraft feral druid from Tirelion. So she was an incredibly, incredibly powerful magic user. She still is. Might actually be the strongest one currently in a living state on Azeroth. But I don't know if anything explicitly says that she used magic to really beguile the subjects.
No, it is possible that she did so. She is powerful enough that she could have done so. But nowhere in the books and nowhere in like any of the chronicles or anything in the game has it ever been explicitly said that Azjara was using magic to manipulate her followers. She didn't have to. She was just that incomparable. Azjara was born with golden eyes, which is a rare thing among the Night Elves, and it usually indicates a great destiny.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like by itself something that would cause them to revere her, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like the first thing about her is she was born with golden eyes. She was apparently incomparably beautiful from like very very early age. It's her power is seen more in the fact that she could stand there in front of Manoroth and Manoroth couldn't attack her. Like he realized this was somebody that killed. It would take a kill Jaden or perhaps even a Sargeras to stop.
And like even then, it wasn't certain, right?
Well, Sargeras probably could do it. I mean, come on, Sargeras. But even if he hadn't, he would never have thought, well, Sargeras might not even be able to do this. But he would absolutely did think that about Kil'jaeden, that even Kil'jaeden or Akamond might not be able to stop her. That's where you get, you know, the estimation for her power is nothing to do with her beguiling the Night Elves. She beguiled the Night Elves with sheer charisma. Now, did she use magic to become more charismatic? Probably, in that she would, you know, it would be part of her daily ritual. You know what I mean? Like, she would use magic to shorten the process of making herself look her best, in much the same way that anybody who is going to be out there using their appearance to manipulate others is going to take a lot of time on their appearance. It's a tool. But there's nothing in the game, there's nothing in any of the lore sources for the game that says specifically that she uses magic to control people's minds. She did not have to. She simply was as Shara, and that was enough. When she rose to power, the city that was then called after her, Azinashari, was originally named Alundris.
Mm-hmm.
The people named the city, they changed the name from after their god to Ashara. That's how much they loved her. She was effectively replacing Elune in her people's hearts. By the time of the War of the Ancients, she had effectively made Elune something people still worshipped, but were like, I don't really bother anymore.
Elune's not here. Ashara is.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a certain level of also like the possibility that some of her magic is almost like subconscious in use too, and there's a possibility that some of that might have been there as well. We don't know because we weren't obviously there, even with the instances that have brought us back to the time where she was not Naugified yet. When we did the Caverns of Time, we did the whole Well of Eternity stuff. There is this sort of feeling or implication that she just exudes sort of magic, which I think is where people kind of get this idea that she possibly used magic to manipulate people. But I think Matt's on the right of it. If it was any magic that was being used, I don't think it was consciously, because I don't think she needed to. But anything that she did for preparations, anything she did to make herself, even if it's like cantrips, like making herself sparkle in the sunlight a very specific way, or drawing attention to herself in a very specific manner, or making sure her hair is absolutely perfect. Like, all of that stuff is valid, and all that stuff is possibly something that she would do. And it is also possible that maybe subconsciously she just had an aura around her that sort of just exuded not just that level of command, but also power. Like, you go back to the whole Manaroth couldn't attack her, possibly not even kill Jaden or Archimonde. That could be just by the sheer stature of her presence, or the fact that, this is going to sound really weird, but I almost equate it to, like, if we were going to go the anime route, like JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, when we talk about the power of people's stands, and I know that there's some people probably rolling their eyes, but it's some people that are probably like, yep, that makes sense. It's this idea that there's sort of like this latent power that sort of surrounds somebody that is kind of comes across in their bearing. And I think that is her. Like, she knows how powerful she is. She knows the depths of her power. Like, even if we go back to, I think it was the Harbingers, right? That was the name of the shorts for Legion.
Yeah.
When you go through her story, and it's the fall of her civilization when everything starts happening, when the world...
Oh, that's Harbingers, but it's not for Legions, for BFA.
For BFA, was it? Was it the one that for HR? Was that it? But I thought it was for Legion.
BFA.
Yeah. Nope. Okay, so it was for...
Jaina, then Sylvanas, then Ashara.
You're right, yes. Okay. But you see her with all of this power, and she's holding back essentially a world's worth of catastrophe for a very commendable amount of time. And it wasn't until she, like, expended everything she had that she made that deal. And it wasn't a deal that she was entering into thinking, yeah, I'm going to be in service for the rest of my life. No, it was, this gives me more power to save my people. This gives me more power than I had before, and I can keep going. And even with her representations in the game over the years, we've seen her pop up in visions. We've seen her pop up with a lot of the Naga questing throughout Azeroth, throughout all of the years that the game has been around. There's always this sort of presence to her. And it's always sort of like this, I don't want to say like a dread, but it's like just this awe-inspiring command presence. And whether that's magic or just her, it could be both. It could be just her, could be just magic, but... Yeah, she didn't need to sit there and manipulate memory. She didn't need to sit there and, you know, dominate somebody's mind. They wanted to serve her willingly. And I think part of what you're saying here is correct. I think that it is sort of like, this is the ultimate expression of us as a people. She is our leader, and she has the golden eyes. And that means she has a great prophecy. She's going to do well by us. Look at how much we prosper under her. And they sort of have that sort of projection where their prosperity is her prosperity and vice versa. And it isn't until, you know, the world is sundered and everything splits apart and they start realizing, oh, she started making deals with demons. She started making deals with old gods and all this other, and like everything is horrible and things are blowing up, that really anybody second guess that, really.
I mean, another way to put this is real simple. Lord Ravencrest whilst leading the revolution to attempt to save his people from the demons, and realizing that the Highborn were in it with the demons, still thought Ashara was on their side.
Mm-hmm.
He still wanted to save her. He had to be convinced otherwise. I can't remember his name, but you fight him in the Well of Eternity, Varathan, Captain Varathan, I believe.
Yeah.
He literally had no visible emotion. He showed no emotion at anything. And yet he was so wildly in love with Ashara that she could order him to do anything and he would do it. And she didn't need to manipulate him, I mean, except by just being her. It was sheerly, like, I think that Ashara would have thought that using magic to directly affect people's minds was crass.
Yeah, it was not elegant at all, not even close. That's
not something she would have felt she needed to do. When you go to Well of Eternity, when you attempt to attack Ashara, she never directly fights you.
No.
She just sits behind her shields and then just leaves. You know, she doesn't take a shot. Doesn't.
You're no nothing to her.
Yeah. So is it within her capacity to have done it? Yes, she could do it. She's quite capable. 10,000 years ago, she was one of the strongest magic users ever to exist. And that was 10,000 years ago. She's had time to get better. Let me put it to you this way. Jaina Proudmoore required you to use Azerite from the heart of Azeroth to connect a portal out of, you know, I can't remember the name of Nazjatar.
Yeah. Nazjatar. Yeah.
Yeah. In order to make a portal out of Nazjatar, she needed a ley line nexus and the power of the heart of Azeroth to get around the interdiction that Ashara had put down. And keep in mind, Ashara knew that she was doing it. Ashara let her do it.
Yep.
Because she wanted that group of adventurers, including the person with the heart of Azeroth, which of course is everybody in the raid, but you know, canonically only one person has. She wanted that brought to her. She wanted it there so she could use it. And she did use it. And she did free Nazoth.
Yeah, and I mean, if you look at that encounter too, she really barely fights you. Because at the first part of that encounter is you fighting her minions and fighting against what she's trying to do with the locks. Like, and even when she is active, she's barely paying you any attention, and it's all about her minions coming to the fight for her. She's barely even paying attention to you. She's busy trying to undo the lock. Again, even in that moment, even with you wailing on her with axes and throwing spells at her, she doesn't care. Not in the way that you would expect. She doesn't fight back with the abandon or focus that most of the other bosses that we've encountered do. Gahoon paid more attention to us than she did. And I think that's lost on a lot of times, because it's like, oh yeah, we beat her and then she got taken away into Nazoth's, you know, Black Empire little. It's like, no, she expended her power and our power to release him. She was just tired from doing what she had to do. It wasn't us. She did that. She made that choice and put herself in that position. And I think that's something that people should remember about her. And even now, like, after we freed her, she's still there. She's still out there. And the entire time, and I've been bringing this up for forever, while we're dealing with everything that's happening in the Shadowlands, there is literally nobody watching her. Because all eyes are on the jailer. And yes, that's important, but she is one of the most dangerous villains we've ever faced, because she's smart and powerful. And now she doesn't have any checks and balances. And the only thing that was sort of keeping her in remote check, which is Nazoth, is either dormant or something else has happened to him. But he's sort of out of the equation for right now. So is she going to pop back up? Is she going to be probably more powerful than she was before? Yeah, I'd put money on it. Is she going to have still a cavalcade of followers? Yes. It's just how good she is at that too, because even in their current state, they still follow her. They could have rebelled. All those Naga could have rebelled or tried to do something else. They didn't. All the ones that she sent to go work elsewhere throughout the rest of Azeroth, or even in Outlands, they could have turned their backs on her. They didn't. They were operating under orders. This is when you talk with Lady Vash in Shadowlands, you get a feeling of that, where it's like, yeah, this is all part of the plan. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, she didn't need ultimately, she didn't need magic, but I think you're right in a lot of the things you say here. I think that is partially why people, the ghosts, hated Prince Ferondas so much. I think there's a lot of that to it. And again, I don't think she needed any magic. All right, I think we're going to move on to the next one, unless you have anything else you want to say about Queen Ezhara.
No, I think that you're dead on about the idea that the people were loyal to her personally. I definitely think that she was idealized. Mm-hmm. Essentially, it wasn't even necessarily Ezhara herself. It was their platonic conception of Ezhara. It was what they thought she was like. It was what they imagined this perfect person to be. And, you know, everyone's told that she's perfect. She's glorious. She's wonderful. But you don't see her. The average Calderai never saw her. She's over in Zin Ashari, surrounded by the Highborn.
Mm-hmm.
If she saw it all, you'd like maybe once every few years she'd come out for some event. She was an idea to them.
Or an ideal. As a result,
yeah. But an ideal that is held up not through their own actions. Like, no, she didn't have to do anything. Like, the entire society was built around venerating and revering her.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think you've got an interesting point about this, and I don't disagree with it.
All right. Our next question comes from Belloc of Dragonflight. They are a frequent flyer here and happy to have more questions from him. This is a three-parter. Dear Watchers, after the recent raid cutscenes were released, I've been left with several questions that I was hoping you could answer. Spoilers ahead. Twice now, the jailer has reached into a small portal and pulled out a blue crystal. One was used to make a Mournblade, the other was stuffed into Sylvanas. Are they souls? Part 2. If they are souls, whose got forged into Anduin's sword? And 3. If Sylvanas did just get her soul back, what does that mean? Is she alive, undead, or something else? Oh, I apologize, this is a four-parter. And finally, the jailer revealed his grand plan at the end of the raid, and Sylvanas was shocked enough to turn on him. What does she think his plan was all this time that she was serving or helping him? So I guess we can start with the first one. Matt, what do you think? Is what he's pulling out of there like crystallized condensed souls?
Well, if you do the Kyrian thing, at one point you and Uther go to the jailer's repository of souls. Yeah, yep. He's got a whole place where he's keeping souls. And the souls have fancy titles rather than, like, they don't just say, this is Jim's soul. They have, like, you know, soul of the tortured one or something. So, yeah, they're souls. That is what they are.
Yeah, and they are very, you are right, they're very specific souls. I actually took a whole bunch of screenshots when I was in there the last time. Let's see here, what do I have? There was the Holy Lightbringer, which I believe that was Uther at that point. There was the Champion of Peace. There was the Archmage's Mentor. There was the Golden King, the Blood Queen, the Grand Magister, the Guardian of Naxxramas, and the Betrayed Father. So I'm pretty confident you can go through sort of the WoW history books and kind of pick out who some of those are. And there's definitely some very heavy implications there. But yeah, we know they're souls. We know that they are from his private stock and collection inside of Torghast. Because like Matt said, we stage a heist. It was a really cool, interesting quest that got my head spinning of what else he has access to. But now the part two is if they're souls, which we can assume they are, who's got forged into Anduin's sword?
Mine, sorry.
Matt,
I wasn't using it.
Matt the Mournblade Rossi. All right, that's going to be a thing now.
No, I honestly, we don't know. That the quick and easy, simple, true answer is we don't know. We can speculate. The way I see it, there's a few candidates.
Mm-hmm.
An easy candidate is Arthas.
Yeah.
Because we know that, A, he wanted something like what Arthas was, and he's also angry at Arthas for having failed him.
We know that Ner'zhul was split off from the Lich King soul.
Yeah, because we see Ner'zhul.
We fight Ner'zhul. We fought the remnants of him.
And also, we know that Arthas was tossed bodily, you know, or not bodily, because it was his spirit, but, you know, he was tossed into the maw by Uther and Davos. And we know that, you know, she was working with the jailer, so it's possible that, you know, she threw him in there on the jailer's behalf after she got mad at the Archon for not taking the whole threat of the maw seriously. Apparently, she decided, I'm just going to go work for the maw then, which is a little weird, but, you know, whatever. Arthas, I think, is a candidate. Some people are saying his dad, and I don't think that's the case. It doesn't feel to me like Varian would be a good choice.
No.
If you wanted to corrupt Anduin. Varian would fight really hard to not do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think Arthas is a good possibility. I mean, Benedictus, maybe? I mean, I can't really think of anybody else. I mean, who would you think it might be?
I mean, and this is something I've been talking about with a couple of our listeners on Discord and Twitter a little bit. I keep leaning towards Arthas as well. If for no other reason, we haven't seen anything with Arthas outside of Uther's memory. And when we... I mean, he could be the Golden King, but I don't think that's him. Because he was never actually king. Even as a Lich King, he wasn't actually a king. He was never crowned or coronated. And it seems to make the most sense. There's a lot of parallels between Anduin and Arthas that people like to point out. And what better way to exert control over somebody than using something that seems to be a little more attuned to them? It also would make sense in regards of like who Anduin is. What other way would make sense of something you've already dominated, something you've had for a little bit, something you've already shredded, but then resonates with his sense of duty, his sense of his wanting to protect his people, the sense of being a young king, beyond before his time or having to make difficult decisions, because we know that that's something Anduin struggles with. And so did Arthas. That is sort of the whole crux of Arthas's kind of descent into becoming the Lich King, right? It's making these hard decisions that he felt he had no choice but to make. And I think it's a really good candidate. I don't know anybody else that would really make sense. I would have said possibly Ner'zhul, but we fight Ner'zhul. We fight the remnants of him, whatever's left. We know that it's been split up and pulled apart. And it's in Torghast. It's in the Sanctum of Domination. We see nothing of Arthas there, literally nothing. And one would also think that if given the opportunity, if nothing else in the Sanctum of Domination, which Sylvanas seems to have pretty good run of the place, why wouldn't she want to take a crack at Arthas' soul? Yet you don't see that. And it's not something she's doing, talks about doing, or anything else. The only thing that I could see preventing her from trying to like exact some form of revenge or inflict some form of pain to say, this is what you made me feel, now it's my turn to make you feel it, would be if it wasn't accessible to her. It wasn't something that she was allowed to see. And it also seems like Arthas would probably be one of those souls that he would keep in his private reserves. Because again, you have Arthas's father, why can't I think of his name now?
Tyrannus Manithil.
Thank you. Who I think is one of those souls. You have the Blood Queen Lanithil, which was one of the Lich King's servants. You have all these things that seem to fit right into that. These are prized possessions. Think that would be a good guess. The third question part was, did Sylvanas get her soul back, and what does that mean? Matt?
Well, if she got her soul back, she is not alive. She's obviously still undead when you see her. Her physical form hasn't changed at all. I think her eyes are the only thing that changes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think she's still undead. You can have an undead with a soul. The soul thing seems to be specifically when you're killed with a Mournblade, it damages your soul. I don't even think that was her whole soul. I think it was a part of it, much in the same way that Uther had lost a part of his soul.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so part of his soul went to be part of the Kyrian, and the wound that he had on his soul was the wound created by the Mournblade. It was Frostmourne did that. And I think Frostmourne cleaved off a part of Sylvanas as well. I think that that's what it was. It was a chunk of her soul. It was a piece of her. So I think she's still undead. I think she's just the part of her that was gone, the part of her that was gone all this time, the part of her that, you know, made her the full person is now back. She can probably feel more now than she could before. Like, she talks about it in, if you read War Crimes, there's a part where she talks about how
the phantom
emotions
limb.
To her are like a phantom limb. Like, yep. She doesn't. She can't make them work, but she can still feel them. And I think that that's related to this. In terms of what does it mean, I think it just means that she's going to be suffering. Because before, she didn't seem capable of remorse. If you look at things that Sylvanas has done in the past, she doesn't seem capable of remorse. She doesn't seem to regret, perhaps, but remorse didn't seem to be the case. But now she probably is. And if she is, she's about to be reliving a whole lot of decisions she made that were causing a ton of suffering and death. And from somebody who died the way she died, it's like, imagine you gave your life, sacrificed your life ultimately, trying to save your people, trying to prevent a horror, and then you spend years mentally crippled and inflicting that horror on people only to finally be able to feel again. I'm kind of likening it to, I have a condition called anhedonia where I can't feel pleasure very effectively. I'm on medication for it, and it's caused me to have some really weird moments when the medication working really well and I feel everything. I don't necessarily feel pleasure. I actually sometimes feel worse because now I can feel fully. So all the stuff that I've been not particularly noticing is now hammering on me. I have not committed mass murder. I have not committed genocide. Sylvanas has done both multiple times. Sylvanas, you know, the suffering of the people of Gilneas is directly on Sylvanas. The suffering of the people of Darnassus is directly on Sylvanas. You know, it's that's a lot. I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens with the character. But I don't know. Obviously, we don't know.
So I'm going to say something that I think is, I don't know if it's going to be received well or not. I think for the first time, yes, she's undead, but I think she's finally forsaken. Because of the people that were raised in undead as part of the Scourge and then got themselves back, they weren't exactly executed by a Mournblade. They were resurrected through necromantic means, but not by direct, like, being cleaved by a Mournblade.
No, they were killed with the curse, the plague of undeath.
And then brought back, right. She, however, was, and she was incomplete. And we know this, and I was thinking about this going back to, like, Before the Storm. And it's one of my favorite books because it gives you such an insight into how the Forsaken operate. We know that sometimes their emotions can be turned up to 11 depending on how they were resurrected. We see this in Shadows Rising. But in Before the Storm, they're still a people. They still have the memories of who they were in life, and they don't seem to be given to too many extremes. In fact, the Council of what is it? Council of Desolation?
Desolate Council.
Desolate Council. They're not caricatures of who they were in life. And Sylvanas, for the longest time, really kind of was. Because she had, like Matt pointed out, that phantom limb of emotion. She couldn't feel things. But when we were going through that book, these Forsaken are feeling things. They feel loss and regret and sorrow and love. And there's this, like, even in the moment when they're meeting with the people that actually came from Storm and their family members that actually came to see them, it talks about the joyous reunion after, like, you know, this sort of, like, tentative, like, meeting of the folks where that's like, there's wariness, this uneasiness. And then there's this extreme joy. And they, again, are not caricatures of themselves. They're not just amped up to 11 in one direction. And I think that maybe I've been thinking about the Forsaken wrong up until this point. And when Sylvanas got her soul back, it made me start to think that maybe now she's actually forsaken. She can actually feel. She can actually feel completely. She can actually understand in the same way she would if she was living, but in the same way that other Forsaken have been able to do forever now. And I think that's what it is. She's still undead. She's not alive. And I don't think she's something else. I think she's just finally becoming slotted into that position of being forsaken. Part four, with the jailer revealing his grand plan at the end of the raid, the question is, what did Sylvanas think his plan was all this time that she was lending him a hand?
It's not that she thought his plan was different. It's that she thought the goal was different. The point where she turns on him is when he says, "All shall serve me."
Mm-hmm. Yep.
He had not indicated to her that he wanted to control everything. He told her that the cycle of life and death was broken, that it led to misery and torture, like the torture she'd been through, that there was no point to any of it, and it needed to be destroyed and remade. She says this to Anduin. She talks about it repeatedly.
She's been talking about it for years.
She talks about how unfair it is, how pointless it is. You know, that this is, you know, you live your life and then you die and you end up shuffled into this afterlife. And it's like, for what? Why was it, you know? And so when he tells her he's going to destroy everything and remake it, she thinks that'll be a better existence. It'll be more fair. We won't live and then die. We'll just exist. We'll just all be, you know, we'll all be the same. And life won't be there to just be a joke where you end up, like, you know, sorted into some, like, house after you die.
And then,
you know,
still have to serve.
Yeah. That's, that's what she believed the plan was, and that is the plan. He does still intend to do that. It's just that, oh, he happened to reveal that when he does that, he's going to put himself on top and everybody else gets to serve him. So instead of four groups that kind of force you to join them and force you to do what they think you should be doing, there will just be one dictator who tells everybody what to do, and everyone's existence is just going to be that. That's what she reacted to. That's, you know, whether you think Sylvanas Moonrunner is a good person or not, that's totally up to you to make that kind of value decision. But it is clear that Sylvanas Moonrunner has never been somebody who likes to be told what to do.
Yeah, and we've brought this up a lot. Like, it's that that idea of servitude is really the linchpin of it.
Yeah, and going back even to when she was alive, mm-hmm. Sylvanas once told Kael'thas to step.
The prince.
The prince of Silvermoon. Her, you know, directly, her social superior, if not directly above her in the line of succession. Yeah. You know, theoretically, an Asterion was her commander, but this is still the guy who's going to be king comes up to you and says, you should get rid of that human. And she's like, F you. Did I miss a meeting where you became head of the Farstriders? No, I'm still Ranger General. Okay, then I'm going to do what I want to do. And if anybody has a problem and their name isn't Anisterion, they can shuffle off. And if their name is Anisterion, he can accept my resignation. Because I will not be Ranger General if I am not Ranger General.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and she just flat out told him, no, I'm not doing anything you told me to do. I don't have to. So this is somebody who has never liked being told what to do. And for good reason, because she usually was the smartest person involved in any decision being made around her. Unless Illyria was in the room. Or their mom, I suppose.
Yeah.
And that's, to me, that is a through line that works for Sylvanas. And in no way does this, every time I say something it's even remotely positive about Sylvanas, people are always
it's
like,
it's not,
you know,
absolution.
Yeah, it's not absolution. I don't think what happened to her is absolution. And I don't think turning on the jailer is absolution. It doesn't change what she did.
Mm-hmm.
And the worst part for her is going to be knowing that she did that.
Not that there shouldn't be other punishment levied with it, no. But I mean, she has to feel the weight of it.
I'm going to be up front. I still think the end of this expansion, she's going to be taking on the Maw. I think she's going to basically become the jailer of the damned.
Yeah, a lot of people have been saying that.
Yeah, I really do think so. But regardless, she knew what his plan was the whole time. She just didn't know that, you know, he had left out that part where he remade the universe to basically everyone be his slaves forever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the part she's like, wait, whoa, we didn't talk about. No, that's not what we said. Yeah, that is my opinion.
I agree, actually. And that's one of the things that I was going to point out is, again, you hit the nail on the head. It's that servitude. It's that idea that she was serving. Like, up to this point, she was being asked to do things, but there's a difference between commanding somebody and, like, the jailer going, I need this done, can't go and do this for me, and not giving, like, an exact step-by-step. It's the difference between micromanagement and just saying, I need something. And
well, Sylvanas, for her part, Sylvanas herself was a general.
Yeah.
She understands command.
Exactly.
It doesn't make the people you're commanding your slaves.
Exactly. And so she's getting issued commands and tasks that align with what she's expecting. At the end of it, not having servitude. And that's one of the things that I think they really drove home in the story of the Covenants. All of them. Not just, Bastion. Not just Maldraxxus. If you are part of any of those cycles, you serve. Whether you're tending groves, whether you are tending the penitent, whether you are defending the Shadowlands from incursion and threat, or whether you are ferrying souls to Ouroboros for sorting, you are serving. You still have a duty. You still have a role. And in some of them, it's been very, like, that's how the Forsworn became a thing, because it was supposed to be blind servitude. There was supposed to be this line in the sand that you did not cross. You just did what you were told. Maldraxxus, to the same thing, was like, it was survival of the fittest, the strongest led. And then the Primus was gone and there was nobody in central command. So it sort of devolved, but you went there. And if you were sorted into Maldraxxus, you served in the army. Like, or you served in the spy corps, or you served in the magic corps, or whatever the case is, you had a role. And so when Sylvanas is shown that and said, here's your afterlife, here's what waits for you after you die, you still must serve. After being yoked by the Lich King for a good long length of time, like, that was not a short period of time in which the Lich King was doing his thing, before she gets any modicum of control back, then finding out that you've been pushed or pulled or manipulated to do certain things maybe that you didn't expect, and then getting to this position where you've shown that, yeah, and then being told, yeah, by the way, everybody's going to serve me. Yeah, that's the point. And again, it doesn't absolve her of anything she's done, but that's the turning point. It has nothing to do with what she thought she was doing. She thought she was breaking everything so that people wouldn't have to serve and could make their own choices in mm-hmm. life and in death. And
she was trying to free us for all that, you know, that everything she's done is awful, mm-hmm. but she even says, I'm, you know, this will be freedom. I'm going to free everyone. You know, the reason that, you know, it's kind of like the sunk cost fallacy where you hear that the idea over and over again, I can't stop now. I've put too much into this. That's definitely part of it, is that Sylvanas was definitely thinking, you know, I've already gone this far. I can't back out now. But also, like, when you see her talking to Anduin, she really means it.
Mm-hmm.
This is what's going to happen. It's going to free everybody. She says it. Anduin mocks her for it. Well, not really mock.
He points out the fallacy of it.
Yeah, you've got to understand that this guy can't be trusted, that this is, you know, BS. But I do think that it took her up until that point to finally say, ah, crap. Because mm-hmm. she was holding out hope that he wasn't full of crap. She was holding out hope that he was going to break everything and remake the universe, and it was going to be like he said. Even though she, it was in the back of her head that this is, you know, watching him parrot, you know, puppet Anduin around, she had it in the back of her head, oh, this is not going well. This does not bode well for Operation Save Everybody. But actually hearing it from him is you can keep deluding yourself, and the guy actually says it right there in front of everybody that that's what he's going to do. Then, yeah, that was the moment where she's like, ah, here we go. So, yeah, I do definitely think that it's not the plan that changed, and it's not the plan she wasn't aware of. It was his motivation.
Mm-hmm. So hopefully that answers your question, Bellic, and we're going to move on to our next one, which comes from our good friend Godzilla, because radioactive giant lizards are always our friend. Question for Lorewatch. In the past, we all kind of assumed that the Night Warriors pretty much get a free pass to Ardenweald when they die, but the Lady Kalik and the Stone Rite confirmed that Night Warriors, it seems, that any Night Warrior can be sorted and out in the Shadowland. What are your thoughts on this? Did Alun just favor Theranax, or do you think it's just as simple of being a Night Warrior isn't a direct ticket to Ardenweald?
I mean, it could be both of those things.
Yeah, they don't necessarily have to be exclusive, right? I mean,
Theranax was like the first Night Warrior. He was the first time anybody did it. And he did it in service of, you know, her, in a direct service, you know, trying to defend a world from like an actual old god. So, I mean, it just might have been Theranax had earned his place in Ardenweald. It could just be that simple. Maybe no Night Warrior is guaranteed there any more than they're guaranteed anywhere else. I don't know.
So there was something that was said during the whole cinematic thing that really kind of stuck out to me, and I'm kind of curious if this sort of stuck out with you. It's when Alun is sort of in full possession of Taran's body, and they're talking, her and the queen are talking to each other, the Winter Queen are talking to each other. She says to her, this one has to make the choice. So it made me start to think, maybe we've been thinking about the Night Warriors all wrong, in so much as they don't get a free ticket to just Ardenweald. Maybe they get to choose. Maybe there's an element of that where they can say, I want to keep serving, so I'm going to go and, you know, work in you know, Ardenweald tending groves, or maybe I want to go and work in Revendreth and make people, like, cleanse their sins and tend to those that want to be better, or maybe I want to keep serving in the military. And maybe that's what actually, like, Alun's gift to the Night Warriors is when they pass. It's not that it's a free ticket to Ardenweald, but it's a free ticket to choose, not necessarily be sorted, because that seems to fit with the personalities on display. Like, when you're doing that whole quest and you're talking to the individual Night Warriors, and talk to them after you're done with the whole Taran thing, and you get the idea that these were conscious choices that they made. And I also found it very telling that none of them were in Bastion, because you would think that if it was an automated sorting thing or something where the Arbiter was doing the sorting for it, that at least one would wind up in Bastion. but then they would be devoid of all their memory. And what good would they be at that point, right? So I'm thinking maybe they got to choose where they went, and they got to choose what their service was in the afterlife. What do you think of that?
Or
do
you think I'm completely out of wrong? I don't think the choice that she was talking about was anything like that. I think she was talking about the choice between vengeance and,
sure,
you know, I don't know if the word protection would be the right word.
Renewal.
Like, do I help heal the wounds or do I destroy? And the thing is that Elune does not present this as a moral, like the choice with like a one moral outcome and one immoral outcome. It's just a choice. Tyrande can choose to seek out her revenge, or she can choose to help the people of Ardenweald. It's a decision that she can make. So I think that's what the choice that she was talking about was. But it is an interesting thing to think about the possibility that the Elune is short-circuiting the whole Arbiter process. Now that we've learned that the Arbiter was basically just a chunk of Zoval the whole time, this does imply that Zoval was the one doing this before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Zoval used to be the guy sorting everybody. And, you know, I've said before, and I'm sure I'll say again, that the Maw, I definitely feel like at one point there was a Shadowland. There was one place that had at least all the ones we've seen so far. It was one place that had Ardenweald in it. It had Bastion in it. It had Revendreth in it. It had Maldraxxus in it. And it had the Maw in it. I think it was like just there was one realm ruled by Zoval.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he did something so awful that they rebelled against him and threw him down. And in the process, the Maw was sundered away and turned into a prison to hold him. The fact that Maldraxxus seems to be like a literal living thing or undead thing kind of makes me wonder about that too. Like if the realms were like were actually they seem to take on the form that they require to be suitable for their purpose. If that was always the case, or if like Zoval did that across the entirety of the Shadowlands, but we hear that when the Winter Queen first came to awareness, she arrived in
Ardenweald,
and you know, the place took on the form it did because of her. Was that the case when they were all connected, or, you know, were they all connected? I mean, I think that, but that doesn't mean it's true. There's a lot to this. You know, I still want to know, how is Elune her sister?
Yeah.
What does that mean? If Elune is from, say, if the Emerald Dream turns out to be the exact opposite of the Shadowlands and Elune is from there, what is she? Is she like a first one? Is she, is she of similar being to the Winter Queen, like just created in a different way? Or what's going on with that? They obviously think of themselves as sisters. They speak to each other as equals. The Winter Queen is actually resentful at first until Elune's like, I heard you. I tried to send you my people. What more do you want? And, you know, the Winter Queen's like, they didn't get here. They all went to the Maw. And she's like, dang, that's not good. So, there's a lot to this that I want to know more about. I do think that it would be interesting if they get to choose, or if it's just the case that being, they might have been Night Warriors who went to Bastion, but since they forgot everything, we don't know that they went to Bastion. Like, what would the point be of trying to recruit them to help in this when they wouldn't remember anything? You know what I mean? Like, so they might have gone there and then just, you know, lost their memories. You know, so we don't, there's no point to trying to get them. That's one possibility. It might not be that they chose not to go to Bastion. They might have chosen to go to Bastion and then, you know, some of them might have wanted to forget.
It's true.
You know, if you lived a life where your life was so bad that you felt the need to allow your god to bodily inhabit you, knowing it's going to kill you. Like, you know, Tyrande might have chosen to forget if given the opportunity. You know, she chose something else apparently. But if they're given the option to choose, some of them might have chosen, yeah, wipe my mind. I don't want to remember any of this.
You know, that, and that's fair. That is absolutely fair.
But, you know, we don't know. This is all, it's fun to speculate. I do think it would be interesting. I do want to know more about the Elune Winter Queen relationship. I want to know.
Very much so.
Yeah. Like if we've got the Winter Queen and Ardenweald, and that's kind of like their version of the Unseelie, what's the Seelie like? What are they? Where are they? Is there a realm? Is there a realm in the Emerald Dream where it's like the opposite of Ardenweald, where it's permanent summer? Like what's up with that? Why is Elune there? Elune is the moon, you know, not the sun.
Yeah, but the moon is often associated with like fertility and stuff like that.
Hold on, no, I'm not done.
Sorry.
We know that the Tauren believe that Elune is one of two. That there's Aparo, the sun, who is Elune's like, you know, exact opposite, yet also like effectively her mate. And I don't know. I'm just saying there could be all sorts of stuff going on here that we have yet to even hear about. And I'm very fascinated in this. We do know that Alun, you know, you can use the Tear of Alun to activate a Naru core.
Mm-hmm.
And we still don't know why. When we're told that it's supposed to be a Naru of the same line as that Naru. Did Alun make the Naru? You know? There's a lot we don't know. There's a lot we don't understand. So, yeah, I am still looking forward to it. But in terms of, you know, I kind of got off track a little bit and I'm trying to, like, bring it back. I'm trying to figure out how to, like, you know, put it back. But I think basically we have to admit that we don't know yet what the deal is here. I do think that it's definitely the case that the Night Warriors don't seem to be forced to go to Ardenweald or allowed to go to Ardenweald so much as they seem to go to wherever anybody else goes. Whether they do that through sorting, whether like the Arbiter just weighs them and says, oh yeah, you should go here, or if they just get to pick, we don't know that yet.
Yeah, and I think there's some open-endedness specifically in there that we have yet to get answers for, and I'm actually looking forward to it because I want to know more about, like you said, the relationship between Alun and the Winter Queen. And I know we've gotten questions about that, so like we'll get to that at some point, folks, when we can talk a little bit more about it. But there is definitely a lot more questions there. It starts to throw into sort of question everything we think we know. And that's sort of a theme with this expansion, which I appreciate to a certain degree. It's you think you know how things are going, but this is different than what you even expected. Like, we expected the Shadowlands to be a realm of death. We didn't expect it to be as ordered as it was. We didn't expect to have a cycle for some of this stuff where gods could be reborn back into our world. Why is that the case? Why is that only the case in Ardenweald? Why isn't that anywhere else? Why was that specifically set up? Is there a reason for it? Why is Alun and the Winter Queen on that familiar level? Why do they talk to each other as equals? Is Alun still inside of Tirand? Or is that tear that was formed at the end of that cinematic, is that the representation of her letting go of her quest for vengeance and, you know, taking that power that would eat her alive and condensing it down to a brand new tear of Alun, which was corrupted and then destroyed before previously, you know, with Ysera, that whole thing. Like, there's a ton of questions.
It wasn't destroyed, sorry.
Yes, that is correct.
Although I don't think that Alun was ever inside Tirande. I think she was speaking through her.
Sure.
I don't think she was actually in there. But I think even the attempt at trying to channel that much of Alun is what burns them out. It's just too much.
Yeah. Giant cosmic power, itty bitty tiny space. Yeah, that makes a whole lot of sense. We could go on about this, and we do have other questions that we didn't get through today. But I'm going to end today with a final thought, sort of, because we're kind of coming up on time. What do you want the next chapters to begin to address? The story that we've gotten so far has been pretty... I mean, it's been driving towards the whole Zolval thing and everything else. And now we've just done the Bastion thing. We've just done Uther. We've just done the Night Warrior stuff. What else do you feel should be addressed or would you like to see addressed in the upcoming chapters?
Trust.
I was waiting for it. I knew it.
Trust. They're not of rust. They're a bunch of guys that have done some stuff. Come on.
Sorry. No, I would agree with you. Like, I feel that there's been a very distinct lack of Drust accountability after the Ardenweald stuff. I want to know more about it. I also really want to know why Zolval has a very Drusty appearance with all that stuff taken into him, because that is opening
up. He's totally Drusty. He's not quite Trusty.
Oh, goodness. I'm totally clipping that. But yeah, I would like to see more about the dress as well. Is there anything else that you think you'd want to know more about? I also want to see brokers. Like, we got Tazavesh.
No, I don't actually want to see any more about the brokers. I don't care.
Really?
I don't know what it is about the brokers, but they don't do anything for me.
Really? I mean, this is going to sound like a weird question, but you don't feel that same way about Ethereals, do you?
Yeah, I do. I don't care about the Ethereals.
Well, that would make sense then.
Although I care more about, like, the lore of the Ethereals. Like, I'm interested. I want to go to their homeworld. I want to see what happened to it. But I think it's the fact that they're these groups are all portrayed as like these innately super mercantilistic groups, that just doesn't do it for me. That being said, I could be completely changed around on the brokers depending on what revelations come out about them. Like, if we find out that this whole mercantilist thing is just a cover and they're really up to this, then I would be interested, depending on what this is. The fact that they're kind of like trading in souls and soul bits, that's the only thing that I find interesting about them. They're effectively like, you know, they're like people who discover like this magical font of existence that creates all life in the cosmos. And they're like, this should be bought and sold. That's interesting because it's a really horrific, awful response to that. So yeah, that I'm interested in. But the brokers themselves, I would not be surprised to find out they were like, you know, magical robots made in one of the like places like, oh bloody heck, Korthia.
Like a celestial forge almost kind of spit them out.
Yeah, it surprised me to find out that they were like magic robots made in Korthia who got loose when their creators were destroyed or something. It wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, I think that for me, the one thing I want to know about brokers is how they're able to travel between Shadowlands and reality so, or our world essentially, so easily in between realms in a way that nothing else seems to be able to do. Like, it took the Helm of Domination a ritual and shattering that Helm of Domination to weaken the walls to the point where we could travel to the Shadowlands. And even then, like, other forays into there were so weak or limited, as in the stuff with the Death Knight starting zone. Why are they so special? What allows them to do that? And I want to know kind of more about that, because I think there's some interesting implications inside of that. But I think that's going to do it for us today, folks. Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/BlizzardWatch. Your continued support means this podcast lighting community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, better chance at having your question answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ads-free site experience. Again, if you have questions for this or the other shows, be sure to send them into podcast@blizzardwatch.com or one of our various Discord channels. Just please make sure you specify what podcast they are for. Otherwise, Matt and I will have to thumb wrestle and my thumbs hurt. Matt's got more reach than me. I can't compete. It's just how it is.
Freakishly long thumbs. Some have said my thumbs themselves are harbinger of the end times.
They just stick way down. That was me. I said that. Yep.
Yeah, I didn't want to, like, you know, throw that too much out there. But yeah, it's true. He does. He's constantly just, you know, randomly calling me at odd moments, like, you know, oh, hey, it's a Discord call. What's up? Your thumbs are the harbinger of the apocalypse. Click. Oh, yeah, it's good times, man.
Well, now this is going to happen more frequently. But thank you very much, folks. We appreciate everything that you do for us. We do receive those messages. And the last thing I will say is we've gotten a lot of tweets, emails, Discord messages thanking us for coverage and content over the last several weeks. We're glad to use our platform to do that and to echo those messages and have good constructive conversations around that. So thank you very much for your continued support. Thank you for your kind words. We'll see you next week.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.